something that I think you've had your hands into down south a long time ago or some time ago. And if I remember correctly, with large feed lines, large antennas, and I just have a fun little twist on it I'd like to get your opinion on. And we'll just leave it at that. I'll shoot you an email. I'll fill you in.
Okay, this machine's about to be cut off. Do you have the ability to go to the UHF machine, 449-125?
Well, I'll twist the dial over there and see if I can hit it. My reception isn't so good. Well, what's the PL?
136.5 is the PL, same as this machine. 449.125 is the frequency. 449.125, PL 136.5. I'm listening there right now.
Dick and Sweo. What? Dick and Sweo.
John?
Yeah, Wes.
Okay. Can I stay here before we get disconnected and then go 147?
Okay. Works for me.
I've got the patent application, patent is not a patent application. Interesting patent. It was approved a few days ago, and it is utilizing shock waves from the explosive ordnance to create a counter shock wave to protect the vehicles against the shock wave. In other words, is if you have explosive ordnance that is directed to you or it's blown nearby, you could create the counter shock wave using electromagnetic waves, at least they use this term, and to extract it.
How do they do that on tank?
I've heard of that, and they use that. They have been using it, but I don't think it was proven. It was not proven because there's another issue there. It will prevent, like an IED, where they will try to blow up a vehicle. It's very possible. Right now, they have devices where they can explode ordnance ahead of the vehicle to detonate mines, so they are using the concussion effect to eliminate the mine threat. And sure, if it's not a projectile, if it is an explosive device placed near the vehicle, sure, that'll work.
Yeah, I wonder, there was another station. Another station pickup. Okay. I wonder if you know more about it. I'm trying to find where I have the PDF open. Definitely I have it. Somewhere, too many pages. Interesting concept. The thing is that electromagnetic waves, one could ask what electromagnetic waves have to do with longitudinal waves of shock waves.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. You're talking about electrical waves. Okay. I'm not sure. I have no information on that. I haven't heard of that being studied. But I know they were using explosives to counteract explosive charges. So, no, that I know nothing of.
Yeah, I'm trying to get to this one. In the meantime, I can give you a few words about it before I find it. Extremely broad as if they wanted to make sure that they didn't forget anything somebody could utilize anyhow. So they use the term electromagnetic wave, but actually it's a plasma. Now plasma is conducting at the time when the explosive ordnance is being blown. By that, plasma is actually utilizing part of the energy, creating even more heat. That energy, kinetic energy, then is changed to heat and is not impacting directly the vehicles and to exchange.
KC2WGB, I didn't hear anything you said. We were doubling. You picked that up when I was talking. Yeah, they're doing that with plasma, and they have plasma transmitters, they call them, that they can mount on the aircraft. That's what they were talking about. Plus, they're also looking into microwave. So, they say that force field is definitely going to work. It's just, it's very expensive, and they have a way to go with it, but it sounds good.
Yeah. I'm going to repeat that. So plasma, one of the explanations is plasma. When you have explosive ordnance that is being blown, you're by the vicinity of the vehicle. Then you have a shockwave. Now you have a plasma that is being created in the vicinity of that vehicle by the device that is in a vehicle that could be a high current. Because of the properties of the hot air and plasma, plasma is utilizing part of that energy from shockwave, creating even more heat. By that is widening the protective level. Then you have an aftershock or the rest of the energy that could be kinetic energy that then is changed to heat. And that's how they create the protective layers. The more of the shockwave you have, the more protective layer do you have at the exchange.
Okay, well, that doesn't explain actually how it works, but they're not going to give you that kind of information in the patent. But yeah, that sounds good. Military could use it, that's for sure. But I wonder what the action to the explosion will be on the vehicle through the plasma. That might be something they haven't experienced yet. Yeah, it sounds good.
I have it in front of me. Presented is the system and a method of attenuating the shockwave propagating in a first medium by detecting a shockwave producing event, determining the direction of the shockwave relative to a protected asset, and interposing a second target medium different from the first medium between the shockwave and the protected asset, should that such that shockwave produced by the event contacts the second medium as it is attenuated in the energy thereby prior to reaching the protected asset. Okay, whatever. The second medium may be formed by rapidly heating a region of the first medium, so that the second medium differs from the first medium in at least one temperature density and composition. Order. In one embodiment, a system for attenuating a shockwave propagating in the first medium may include sensor for detecting, generating a detection signal, and arc generator is in communication with the sensor and configured to receive the detection. Yeah, so they talk, okay. So they have a detection, and then they have a arc generator. But in addition to that, generator may be configured to heat the selected region by generating an electromagnetic arc, such as an electric arc or laser or microwave, between the protected region and incoming shockwave. one embodiment, the arc the generator may include a power supply for generating the arc and may provide conducting path, conducting path. Now, further down, they explain also another part of the patent, which I believe there are plenty of ideas in it, which actually is injecting into the area around the vehicle a fluid. The fluid is vaporized, a vapor sort of, which magnifies the arc. When the shockwave explosive ordnance comes in contact with it, and it's primarily that vapor is primarily ionized by the arc, then the shockwave kinetic energy make that vapor even more absorbing and widening the layer of the protective layer, but it's also creating layer in within the layer. You have a temperature variation where the kinetic energy is being attenuated and to exceed.
Okay. Well, you know, it really doesn't give us a good description of how it works. They give you the theory. Okay. But yeah, that's been in development a little while. I didn't know a patent was issued for it yet, but I know the military is experimenting with it, without a doubt. But that doesn't stop a missile strike or an ordnance, a shell fired from, say, a howitzer at the tank or whatever. It's not going to prevent that. It has to be an explosive, like, you know, those large satchel charges and stuff like that. I believe that'll work, sure. But a direct hit with some kind of missile or some piece of ordnance, I don't think it's going to do anything.
Yeah, I think so, but they have out-of-contact missiles. Would the missile actually fly over the tank and explode a few feet above the tank and create the tower, the top tower, to actually be ripped off? And I saw it with the Russian tanks. That's the weak point of the Russian tanks. The exact wording. Is the arc generator may be adapted to develop a drive a large electric current through the fluid medium rapidly. In the embodiment in which the medium is atmospheric air, the second medium may differ from ambient air in temperature, density, and composition. With these embodiments, the arc generator may be adapted to create conducting path for the electric current. Accordingly, the arc generator may be configured to generate one or more of the laser-induced plasma channel, LIPC. From converging laser beam, ionizing tracer pellets fired along converging paths and projectiles, trailing fine electrical wires fired along the converging path. In each of those embodiments, an electric arc may be generated to travel along a conducting path created by the dielectric breakdown of ionized ambient air at the selected region. Enter exit.
Okay, well, we don't know what that does. It's like having a Jacob slider around it. That's it. Whatever. Okay. I hope they have fun with that. It'll be a couple of gazillion.
Yeah, and look, it's a fresh patent. March 17, 2015, the date of issue, the date of the filing is May 30th, 2012. Enter issue.
Well, I guess the patent office got that patent pretty quick. That was pretty quick approval. And the military will scoff that up.
I'm not, you know, but the military. Anything that has a value to the military, you're not going to see in the patent office. It's going to be fine to the patent office, but it's going to be sitting down there for the 3 years and nobody's going to look at it apart from the military guys, if they're interested with it. After 3 years, you may have a note from the patent office that it's government secrecy, and for the 12 years you have no right to talk to it. There's another scenario. You will have a few days after you file, when they receive it, letter, and it will be registered letter stating that you it's a government secrecy and act, and you have to keep it to yourself, and you have no right to talk about it. So this obviously was 2012, and we have a 2015. Now we have those 3 years. It looks like a structure of that patent didn't give a too much of assurance to the military that their investment would be properly made. Enter it here.
Well, the military knows that there is no obvious value in it right now. It has to be developed, and they have to spend a lot of money on it. So they don't care. The patent is made. That's good. It's going to take a lot of money. They're going to need a government to back that project. So, I'm sure they're working on it. They're probably discussing it right now, and they need it. They've been talking about putting it on aircraft for a long time, about like 2 years. So, maybe that's what they're planning to do with it. Don't know.
Anybody wants to make a comment? Okay. Now the second one. In Saudi Arabia, two British, I believe, have flied a human wing with a speed of 200 miles per hour and more, with the jet engines on the wings. Pretty spectacular. I'm going to send you a link. It is being published by Russian propaganda. So probably you're going to find the link that is the original one. I'm going to find it for you. Pretty spectacular. Unbelievable. My assumption is that those guys, and those guys maneuver with this thing with the movement of the body. Those guys were, one of the guys older and the other one is young, and the older guy was working on it for 20 years. So they rather do it as a spectacular event for the money to be made. And to exchange.
Yeah, just like the guy with the rocket on his back was flying around, and now they got jet wing plane.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't see anything strange about that. That would work. I don't know how safe it is landing that thing. It's probably heavy. I don't know, have wheels on it?
No wheels. It looks like a flying wing stealth, or with the human body in between. So you have a flying wing. Now you have a human body. The head is the nose of the plane. On the left and right hand side, you have a dual rocket engine. So probably in the wing, which is rigid, you have a fuel tank. Enter it here.
Well, first you said it was jet. Now you're saying it's rocket?
It is a jet. It is a jet. Rocket engine. I use maybe a proper form of description for the engine. It's the jet engine. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because there's a lot of those around. People can get them and fairly cheap, and they're good, reliable things, so yeah, I figured the British would do that.
Yeah, it looks like extremely well made, very much professional way made. Two jet engines on left-hand side wing and right-hand side wing, so we have four engines. Now, the assumption only of mine is that wing by itself must serve as the tank. The thing is dropped from the helicopter, and those guys are making a duo, doing different kind of triggers, but, oh boy, this system can make a so many acrobatic figures you could imagine. Enter XCI.
KC2WGB. Well, sure, they're going to put on shows with that. That'd be fantastic.
Now, I wonder how this thing goes down. The cause of this flying wing, I think people who are listening to us probably are digging in the internet, they're going to find it easily. This thing is expensive. So they didn't show how they land, but there is no other way of landing than only on the some kind of big parachute at 2XGM.
Well, if he has part of the fuselage under him, he may do a like a dead stick landing with maybe he has runners underneath that are part of the wing, which are beefy enough to take that kind of an impact, and he can just slide in. No wheels needed. They've done that many times before.
Not with the speed. For the wing that is short, in order for you, and you have a lot of weight associated with the wing, in order for you to be able to land, you have to take to the consideration the locomotive forces, which would be the speed. This thing needs a speed in order to be able to fly. Enter XGM.
Well, I don't know if it has any glide ratio or not. That's really not important. They've landed jet planes on skids and skis and all that kind of stuff, weighing tons. No problem. They'd be able to do it with a wing, too.
You're talking about the skis. That's fine. But now you have a delicate human body. Enter XGN.
That's why I said if he is laying on a metal surface that's under him, that will strike the ground. You know, I don't know how much of it protects his legs and stuff like that. I'm not looking at the image, but they've been landing planes like that on skids, not the ones that you see extended from the planes. I'm talking, they've even landed huge aircraft on its belly. So there's no issue there. He can do it. Just, you know, he has to adjust his speed and come in. It'd be interesting to know what the glide ratio, if it has one.
Yeah, the problem is that there is nothing beneath him. He's a part of the wing. His body is below the wing. In other words, he is in horizontal position, parallel to the vector of motion. He is like a body of the plane. So the wing is a rigid wing that he's attached to from the below.
Okay, so he's not on top of the wing, he's below the wing, and he's exposed to the ground if he was to land. Oh, maybe he will parachute up, maybe he's wearing a parachute. Maybe the aircraft has a parachute too, because he can't parachute with being attached to the aircraft. That ain't going to work out.
And they didn't show that. But it's interesting. I mean, wow, it's like all of those science fiction for the children about this Superman whatsoever. It's spectacular.
Oh yeah, well, hey, these guys, these inventors and these tinkerers, they do some amazing stuff. Maybe the Army will look into that. Might be able to use it. Never know. But I'm sure they're having fun.
There is material that I went to with links that I have here, I could have low energy from single digit kilo electron volts up to the mega electron volts, mega electron volts. So all of the range of the particle from the X-rays, or the not really particles, but energy levels from the X-rays to even alpha particles, 3-4 mega electron volts, increasing my reach. So digging, and I found an interesting site. I don't know if I have it open. It's a museum history about different kind of proportional counters, the textures. filled with different kind of gases and stuff like that. So I wonder if I have it open. Interesting, not difficult. Then also I went to the magnetic spectrometer. The magnetic spectrometer first used in Argonne National Laboratory. There are plenty of subjects to talk about. In other words, the proportional counters, I don't know if you ever saw that kind of old style, a ball, which looks like a ball, big ball, very much round, like a football ball, and this thing was having one wire inside and was able to get the counts. The counts could come from a cosmic ray or muons or even neutrons from the space, but it could also measure the neutrons that are coming from any kind of specimens.
Tom, did you ever saw that stuff?
Well, it depends on how old the ones you're talking about. It sounds like the original electrometers and what they were using them for. They had a chamber, which you can still do today. You take an electrometer, make a little chamber out of the coffee can and stuff, and you can count. Sure.
But there are a number of proportional counters. One of them is Geiger-Müller. But the reason that it got into that ball light, see, in order for you to, in proportional counting, to find out, to make sure that you're measuring the right source, not interfering with something that comes from space or from any other specimen, is that you need to know the direction. But the reason they went to the sort of empty bowl with the gas in it and a piece of wire vertically placed was that over there you don't have to know really the direction that particle comes from. It is that you can probability of a particle hitting the gas or a substance inside comes from a geometrical calculation, which the walls of that ball are evenly spaced. So you could have, but that kind of detector was also used in early days for tissue. Human tissue that is has a very little trace of radioactive material, you could put it on a ball that had something like a flat surface on the top of it, or you could not even do it. You could just be next to the person and be able to get that very teeny bitty space amount of radiation that comes from it, and to actually.
Yeah, it sounds like old instruments for sure. But, oh yeah, there's a lot of ways to make detectors, counters, and particle counters or wave game, whatever you want. Absolutely.
Yeah, so that was what I was interested with. There were some interesting discussions. A physics student asked, I understand that the alpha particles are emitted and they are the same as the helium atoms without electrons. But that raises two questions to me. I'm reading right now. What happens with the electrons at the atom that emits them? How now? He now has two electrons too much. What happened to those? So we have a helium atom without electrons. The second question was, why a helium atom? Why not nitrogen, hydrogen, barium, or whatever other elements? So we talk about the nature of alpha. All of the teachers always told me, it emits helium atoms without electrons. There's no these unknown alpha particles. But what hear you? What equation should show the particles that must be helium and 2X3?
Well, once it has no electrons, it's not an atom anymore. You have a nucleus left. So if something is coming out of the nucleus, oh, I don't see anything strange with that. Why helium? Trying to think of the conversion. No, that only happens in heavy metals. I don't know.
One of the answers was, the electron gets lost in a mix. Okay. Eventually, the alpha particle needs to pick them up to become neutral. And the second answer was, nuclear physics theory makes it so. And 2X here.
Well, those answers make sense to you. Very good.
Well, look, I'm dealing with the physics forum, so I'm not dealing with sort of he said, she said. The very brainy guys over here. Another answer is from the science advisor. Alpha particles are especially easy to form in nuclear reaction for two reasons. They are small, just four nucleons, and they are tightly bound 28 mega electron volts binding energy. Going further. Alpha particles are especially easy to form in nuclear reactions for two reasons. Yeah, okay. So there was another guy who was actually referring to the note. It is true, but there are many other things that are small too. Hydrogen, for example, is small. And the idea of two protons and two neutrons can be put together because they are so tightly bound. And that makes me wonder, why do they have to be put bound together? What equation shows that? My textbook doesn't go any deeper that it emits alpha particles. Why are helium atoms without electrons? And then goes on, how you can calculate with that? Why does it need to emit single particle that is tightly bound and has to be small? So, since I don't have any equation or mathematical description of how it is really happening, I'm wondering, why not heavier element are produced? Why not boron atom without electrons, for example? Helium is light, sure, but why does it need to be light? And to
explain. I don't know. I haven't got a clue. I haven't thought about it. So, there's a lot of information there, but, you know, you have to sit down and think about it and map out that structure. And there are, of course, there's formulas that are going to explain it to you, but I don't even think you'd need that.
Yeah, here's the answer from Science Advisor. You find nuclear physics different from other areas of physics. I like that comment. The nucleus is a very complicated object. Fundamentally, it is described by the same laws of quantum mechanics. But applying those laws involves a large amount of calculation. Simple understanding requires approximate models. And it may cease quantitative arguments. You won't find an equation for everything. In any decay of reaction, there are certain amounts of energy available, which must be split into the energy required to create the ongoing particles and the kinetic energy. The more energy it takes to create them, the less there is available to go into their kinetic energy. The less kinetic energy they have, the smaller the phase space becomes. And the smaller the phase space, the less likely they decay. So, in general, decays will produce the lightest particles, and those lightest particles are favored. The one reason why the tightly bound alpha particles are often emitted. Are the factors have to be with binding energy of the nucleus itself? You play with a given number of protons and neutrons have more binding energy, and the ratio between the number of protons and neutrons is important. It might look like beta decay would always be preferred over the alpha decay, but beta decay involves changes from odd to even, or vice versa, and that costs energy. So alpha decay, therefore, mostly happens in cases where beta decay cannot. And to Ishii.
Ishii 2WGB. Well, the only thing I remember is that when they make heavier elements, like, say, 116, they would take lead and bombard that with whatever the additional number that's needed, and they accelerate the lighter product and send that to impact into the lead because it takes less energy to do that. And then they watch the decay, and it usually decays by one or two of the numbers. So you'll see it'll go from, like if it's 114, it can go to either 113 or 112, and that's how they map the decay. That's what I remember from what I read many years ago.
Yeah, well, John, it's very interesting because for me, looking at the possible interaction of particles with the matter in order for the matter to respond with the electric current, one of the ways that seems to be very much promising is beta particles that was used in the past. It's not something that I invented, and I'm smart enough to do it. I found the proportional counter that is 1960, made by Rossi Chamber. And what they say in here is that the proportional counter that employs spherical chamber with the tissue equivalent walls, and the tissue equivalent fuel gas. Its purpose is to measure the dose and the dose equivalent to small volumes of human tissue. The particle chamber was actually used by Harold Rossi in Columbia University. So it looks like a ball that is placed between a two disc, one on the top and one at the bottom. Those are actually the holding discs. So the sphere shape of the chamber was chosen so its response would be more or less independent on the direction from which radiation comes from. So the example would be angularly independent. Now, angularly independent. Could you help me out with the proper pronunciation?
Angular independence.
Angular independence. However, using wire running along the diameter of the sphere and the anode complicates this because the electric field can become distorted towards the ends of the anode, where the leader gets close to the detector walls, to the cathode. Because of this distorted field, gas multiplication would be decreased for the ionizing events that occur towards the end of the anode. So to prevent that, they create a cylindrically symmetrical electric field along the length of the anode. That's why it looks like an empty ball. And it's surrounded by fine helical wire. There is one drawback, which is that helix is susceptible to the vibration, because then you have a vertical wire in it, and those vibrations can result in microphonic noise. Actually, microphonic noise is pretty much present in some of the tanks for high-purity germanium detectors, and there was a problem with it. Most of the high-purity germanium detectors with the liquid nitrogen tanks were mounted on the top of the tank. So you had some boiling, but that didn't affect, and you had the time before the level of liquid nitrogen went all the way to the down to the bottom and affect that with the microphonic noise. noise. But some of the concepts were that you had a container, and on the side of the container nearby the bottom of it, you had side-mounted high-purity germanium detector. And that was actually not a good one, because then the horizontal plane of the leftover of liquid nitrogen was very much affecting that still immersed in the rest of the liquid nitrogen a copper rod from high-purity germanium detector. Enter actually.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I wouldn't know what to do with any of that stuff. It just popped my head. I don't remember any of that. But, no, it's interesting. You like it.
Yeah, there was another one just for curiosity. Very funny. There is a man. And a man is about gosh, you are taller than me. How tall are you?
6 foot.
Okay, so the guy is probably 5.6. And he's holding something that is 183 centimeters, so that would be 6 and something. Now, this is a tube proportional counter that was made for the part of a project trying to find which university it was, but he's holding that. And the construction of the tube is described by Chalk River publication 1961, Solar Geophysical Data, SOLAR. Interesting fact for us ham radio amateur was that in the year 1964, that year was designated by the cosmic ray investigators as an international quiet year of the sun. I don't know if you remember 60s, but 70s, 80s, wow, what a fun on HF. Okay. The detector, which was called NM64, was designed by Hutch Carminchel at Hawk River Laboratory, and they became a worldwide standard for the neutron detection and for cosmic ray studies. Now, this thing is supposed to be mounted in the box, and for the thermal neutrons, cosmic thermal neutrons, surrounded by the polyethylene instead of the paraffin wax, and then those neutrons will slow down and become thermal. So the heavy copper tuning served as a cathode, and it's quite spectacular how they made it. I believe people in the 60s are more practical than right now, because they didn't have that much of technology available on hand. Enter Xia.
Yeah, that's true. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't have the knowledge. They did some amazing things. The 60s were good. They accomplished a lot, I believe.
Yeah, now 199 centimeters length, 14.5 centimeters internal diameter, pressure 0 degrees, 18.5 millimeters. I don't understand that. At 0 degrees Celsius, they had 18.5 millimeter pressure. And it's a bar?
I guess that was probably in inches of mercury, I would assume.
Yeah, in millimeters of mercury, yeah, the bar on the mercury scale. Yeah. Active volume, 33 liters of BF3. And I was trying to memorize what is BF3. Borium, I'm going to tell it to you before I close the page. It's a quite nasty stuff that they used at that time. Copy. Okay, boron trifluoride, BF3 neutron detectors. very nasty stuff. I'm gonna go to the description of it.
I guess they use the boron as the modulator.
Yeah, I'm gonna give you more. The pungent and colorless toxic gas forms with white fumes in the moist air. It is a useful Lewis acid and a very solid building block for other boron compounds. The geometry of BF3 is trigonal planar. The molecule has no dipole moment by virtue of its high symmetry with carbonate anion CO32. If I remember, that was only a boron that was active there, the fluorite. And let me go to the first one. Okay, I got it. A typical BF3 detector consists of cylindrical aluminum brass or copper tube filled with BF3 filled gas at the pressure of 0.5 to 1 atmosphere. So now they give it different. The boron trifluoride gas accomplished two things. C is function of the proportional fuel gas, and C, it undergoes an alpha interaction with the thermal neutrons. To improve detection, efficiency of boron fluoride is enriched with B10. The typical enrichment increased the B10 component to 96% of ordinary boron. The aluminum is typically used as a detector cathode wall because of its small cross-section for neutrons. The anode is almost always single thin wire running, so it's like a Gödel mirror down the axis of the tube. Post-formation by neutrons. When neutron is absorbed by B10 component of gas, an alpha particle and lithium-7 nucleus create primary ion pairs in the gas. So the size of the resulting pore depends on whether the lithium nucleus was left in the ground state or excited state. And then when the lithium nucleus is left in the ground state about 6% of the time, the pore is larger than if the nucleus were left in excited state about 94% of the time. And because the alpha particle and lithium-7 nucleus have more kinetic energy, approximately 2.792 mega electron volts versus 2.3.1 mega electron volts with, that's why they create an ion pair. And then later on, they actually talk about all the stuff related. Tell me what I don't know is whether the boron is the one that actually interacts with the neutrons. Well, see, by looking at the history, 1960, how smart those people were. No wonder we have a John Beck. Until next year.
Next, tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
KC2WGB. I remember boron being used specifically for the moderators. It was very effective for that. Maybe that's what they're using it for. But other than that, I really don't know anything about that stuff.
It's just, you know, additional information. It goes 10% to your brain, 5%, 90%, it doesn't matter. It stays there. It's something that is widening your needed, not needed database. It's something that is trendier. better than commercial from the TV. Hendrix here.
Well, I don't have much of that. Don't watch TV too much. I don't even watch the computer that much. Yep. Very selective on what I take in. Absolutely.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England Reflector. Firm
and
clear.
And everything on that little trip we're going to take.
Yeah, John. So, about the Google mirror, so if we do the comparison, the BF3 detector generates a curve that is very much similar to Geiger Müller detector, and this thing is being used for detection of thermal and fast neutrons. So, are we still having a repeater?
Yeah, seems to be working.
Yeah. So BF3 detectors are exclusively used for slow, low-energy neutrons. The probability that a fast, high-energy neutron would be absorbed by boron-10 is very small to be able to detect fast neutrons. The boron fluoride tube can be used with different kind of moderators, and the thickness of the moderator, which usually will be 1 to 6 inches, depending on neutron energy spectrum. You're looking at something that looks like a piece of garbage. Some of copper tube and put into the box where you have a paraffin or you have a polyethylene. And then one might say, what do I need it for? Scrap it. And it was a piece of art of engineering, piece of art of American brains, in the land of America. It wasn't probably developed by one single guy, because Americans are no longer, or maybe at that time they were, no longer able to think as one. But they think beautifully as a team. And to exchange.
Yeah, we had a lot of good people, still do. They are developing stuff. Some guys do it themselves. Some of the guys in the lab has to get the credit because they like to spread it around, thinking like they're doing something. But, you know, really, what does it mean? Nothing. They built it, it worked, and all there is to it. But, you know, all that stuff like the Geiger counter and all that, that's so passe. It's really not worth anything, and it really doesn't tell you much. But I've seen some of these new little, they're a little bigger than a pack of cigarettes. They sell for like $600, $800, and boy, do they work well. That's amazing what they can fit in that little spot.
So the article is named with Paul Frame, Oak Ridge, Associated Universities. As a matter of fact, Canberra, if I'm not mistaken, is in Oak Ridge, or maybe Vortex is in Oak Ridge. I gotta check it out, but one of those guys in Oak Ridge. Also, they have plenty of small companies that are associated with production of a nuclear samples for the purpose of calibration, or some historically important location in Georgia.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of companies located in Oak Ridge, for sure. There's all kinds of high-tech people, companies, yeah. And the other place, too. What is Kingsford? Change the name. Livermore. Yeah, that's another place that's got a lot of talent.
Oh, Livermore. Yeah, oh boy. Yes. There are a few places and you would say they are at the end of the world. In America, of course. And then one might ask, why there? And to which year?
Well, both Oak Ridge, Livermore, and Sandia, those kind of places, they like to put them in desolate places where there's not too many people, you know, no access, not too much traffic. They got no fly zones over them, stuff like that. So that's why they're located in those remote areas.
Yeah. So you might ask yourself, how come they were able to make a Geiger Müller detector? What sparked them? If I'm not mistaken, alpha particle was discovered in '60s in Turkey.
Alpha particle? I'm not sure. I thought it was before that, but you could be right. Not sure.
I'm gonna tell you. Okay. Alpha particles, two protons, two neutrons. Back to it. History of discovery and use. Wow. I must have John mixed up with the bananas. In 1899 and 1900, Ernest Rutherford and Paul Girard separated British into three times, eventually named Alpha, Beta, and Gamma. Alpha rays were defined by Rutherford as those having glows. I believe he didn't find them at that time. Hold on. In 1907, Rutherford and Thomas Voigt finally proved that alpha particles were indeed helium. Okay. Doesn't say me something, but I... Okay, 1917. Rutherford went to use alpha particles accidentally to produce what he later understood as directed nuclear transmutation of one element to the other in 1970, but still he didn't know what is alpha. Hold on. I've learned it somewhere.
That's all right. That sounds roughly about right, 1917, 1909, somewhere in that area.
I believe he didn't know yet what alpha particle is. Hold on. It was rather a theoretical prediction. Not so very.
Hello, John.
You cannot find it. But I believe in 1919, there was a final years of Rutherford. He produced the artificial disintegration of the nitrogen nucleus. And then he was called back to Cambridge. But I believe he had made a prediction, not the discovery. Okay, John. What you were doing today?
Oh, nothing much. Just, playing around in the lab here, trying to get a few things done. It's such a mess. I haven't been able to straighten it out, and I've been trying, but no success. So, maybe next week I'll get to it. I can't get started on anything because it's just total chaos in here. Like a storm going on. But I'll get to it.
You know what you need? Whenever I found myself exactly at the same point, I took two guys, and I had to pay the guys. Now I had incentive. I gotta finish up, I gotta make it done, because I'm paying the guys. And to actually...
I don't let anybody touch my equipment.
Oh, okay. Well, when I had two guys, I was able to control how they touch it, what they do, and mostly comes good.
Well, if you gotta babysit somebody to do a job, you might as well do it yourself. That's the way I look at it, and... Not that I'm a perfectionist, but I don't want apologies for a broken knob or this is dented or, just don't want it to happen. So, and I don't want to have to watch somebody that closely. So, I'll just get around to it myself. It'll take a little longer. But it's just difficult to move in here. I get so much junk.
Oh, John, you cannot do things by yourself. You have 60, 70 pounds of equipment, just one. And even... when I was doing with 20, 200 pounds, how could I do it by myself?
Paul, I didn't ask you to do that yourself. I wouldn't have anything like that and try to move